This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, visit LibriVox.org. Don Quixote, Volume 1, by Miguel de Cervantes Saavedra. Translated by John Ormsby. Part 4, Chapters 9 through 13. Chapter 9, in which is concluded and finished the terrific battle between the gallant Biscayan and the valiant Manchegan. In the first part of this history, we left the valiant Biscayan and the renowned Don Quixote with drawn swords uplifted, ready to deliver two such furious slashing blows that if they had fallen full and fair, they would at least have split, and cleft them asunder from top to toe, and laid them open like a pomegranate. And at this so critical point, the delightful history came to a stop, and stood cut short without any intimation from the author where what was missing was to be found. This distressed me greatly, because the pleasure derived from having read such a small portion turned to vexation at the thought of the poor chance that presented itself of finding the large part that, so it seemed to me, was missing of such an interesting tale. It appeared to me to be a thing impossible and contrary to all precedent that so good a knight should have been without some sage to undertake the task of writing his marvellous achievements, a thing that was never wanting to any of those knights-errant who, they say, went after adventures. For every one of them had one or two sages as if made on purpose, who not only recorded their deeds, but described their most trifling thoughts and follies, however secret they might be. And such a good knight could not have been so unfortunate as not to have what Platir and others like him had in abundance. And so I could not bring myself to believe that such a gallant tale had been left maimed and mutilated, and I laid the blame on time, the devourer and destroyer of all things, that had either concealed or consumed it. On the other hand, it struck me that, inasmuch as among his books there had been found such modern ones as The Enlightenment of Jealousy and The Nymphs and Shepherds of Henares, his story must likewise be modern, and that though it might not be written, it might exist in the memory of the people of his village and of those in the neighborhood. This reflection kept me perplexed, and longing to know really and truly the whole life and wondrous deeds of our famous Spaniard, Don Quixote of La Mancha, light and mirror of Manchegan chivalry, and the first that in our age and in these so evil days devoted himself to the labor and exercise of the arms of knight-errantry, righting wrongs, succoring widows, and protecting damsels of that sort that used to ride about, whip in hand, on their palfreys, with all their virginity about them, from mountain to mountain and valley to valley. For if it were not some ruffian, or boor with a hood and hatchet, or monstrous giant that forced them, there were in days of yore damsels that at the end of 80 years, in all which time they had never slept a day under a roof, went to their graves as much maids as the mothers that bore them. I say, then, that in these and other respects our gallant Don Quixote is worthy of everlasting and notable praise, nor should it be withheld even from me for the labor and pains spent in searching for the conclusion of this delightful history, though I know well that if heaven, chance, and good fortune had not helped me, the world would have remained deprived of an entertainment and pleasure that for a couple of hours or so may well occupy him who shall read it attentively. The discovery of it occurred in this way. One day, as I was in the Alcano of Toledo, a boy came up to sell some pamphlets and old papers to a silk mercer, and as I am fond of reading even the very scraps of paper in the streets, led by this natural bent of mine, I took up one of the pamphlets the boy had for sale, and saw that it was in characters which I recognized as Arabic, and as I was unable to read them, though I could recognize them, I looked about to see if there were any Spanish-speaking Morisco at hand to read them for me. Nor was there any great difficulty in finding such an interpreter, for even had I sought one for an older and better language, I should have found him. In short, chance provided me with one, who, when I told him what I wanted and put the book in his hands, opened it in the middle, and after reading a little in it, began to laugh. I asked him what he was laughing at, and he replied that it was something the book had written in the margin by way of a note. I bade him tell it to me, and he, still laughing, said, "In the margin, as I told you, this is written. This Dulcinea del Toboso, so often mentioned in this history, had, they say, the best hand of any woman in all of La Mancha for salting pigs." When I heard Dulcinea del Toboso named, I was struck with surprise and amazement, for it occurred to me at once that these pamphlets contained the history of Don Quixote. With this idea I pressed him to read the beginning, and doing so, turning the Arabic offhand into Castilian, he told me it meant History of Don Quixote of La Mancha, written by Cide Hamete Benengeli, an Arab historian. It required great caution to hide the joy I felt when the title of the book reached my ears, and snatching it from the silk mercer, I bought all the papers and pamphlets from the boy for half a real. And if he had had his wits about him, and had known how eager I was for them, he might safely have calculated on making more than 6 reals by the bargain. I withdrew at once with the Morisco into the cloister of the cathedral, and begged him to turn all these pamphlets that related to Don Quixote into the Castilian tongue, without omitting or adding anything to them, offering him whatever payment he pleased. He was satisfied with 2 arrobas of raisins and 2 bushels of wheat, and promised to translate them faithfully and with all dispatch. But to make the matter easier, and not to let such a precious find out of my hands, I took him to my house, where in little more than a month and a half he translated the whole, just as it is set down here. In the first pamphlet, the battle between Don Quixote and the Biscayan was drawn to the very life. They planted in the same attitude as the history describes, their swords raised, and the one protected by his buckler, the other by his cushion, and the Biscayan's mule so true to nature that it could be seen to be a hired one, a bow shot off. The Biscayan had an inscription under his feet which said, Don Sancho de Azpeitia, which no doubt must have been his name, and at the feet of Rocinante was another that said, Don Quixote. Rocinante was marvelously portrayed, so long and thin, so lank and lean, with so much backbone, and so far gone in consumption, that he had showed plainly with what judgment and propriety the name of Rocinante had been bestowed upon him. Near him was Sancho Panza, holding the halter of his ass, at whose feet was another label that said, Sancho Zancas, and according to the picture he must have had a big belly, a short body, and long shanks, for which reason, no doubt, the names of Pancha and Zancas were given to him, for by these 2 surnames the history several times called him. Some other trifling particulars might be mentioned, but they are all of slight importance, and have nothing to do with the true relation of the history, and no history can be bad, so long as it is true. If against the present one any objection be raised on the score of its truth, it can only be that its author was an Arab, as lying is a very common propensity with those of that nation, though as they are such enemies of ours, it is conceivable that there were omissions rather than additions made in the course of it. And this is my own opinion, for where he could and should give freedom to his pen in praise of so worthy a knight, he seems to me deliberately to pass it over in silence, which is ill done, and worse contrived, for it is the business and duty of historians to be exact, truthful, and wholly free from passion, and neither interest nor fear, hatred nor love, should make them swerve from the path of truth, whose mother is history, rival of time, storehouse of deeds, witness for the past, example and counsel for the present, and warning for the future. In this I know will be found all that can be desired in the pleasantest, and if it be wanting in any good quality, I maintain it is the fault of its hound of an author, and not the fault of the subject. To be brief, its second part, according to the translation, began in this way. With trenchant swords upraised and poised on high, it seemed as though the 2 valiant and wrathful combatants stood threatening heaven and earth and hell, with such resolution and determination did they bear themselves. The fiery Biscayan was the first to strike a blow, which was delivered with such force and fury that had not the sword turned in its course, that single stroke would have sufficed to put an end to the bitter struggle and to all the adventures of our knight. But that good fortune which reserved him for greater things turned aside the sword of his adversary, so that although it smote him upon the left shoulder, it did him no more harm than to strip all that side of its armor, carrying away a great part of his helmet with half his ear, all which, with fearful ruin, fell to the ground, leaving him in a sorry plight. Good God, who is there that could properly describe the rage that filled the heart of our Manchegan when he saw himself dealt with in this fashion? All that can be said is, it was such that he again raised himself in his stirrups, and grasping his sword more firmly with both hands, he came down upon the Biscayan with such fury, smiting him full over the cushion and over the head, that even so good a shield proving useless, as if a mountain had fallen on him, he began to bleed from his nose, mouth, and ears, reeling as if about to fall backwards from his mule, as no doubt he would have done, had he not flung his arms about its neck. At the same time, however, he slipped his feet out of the stirrups and unclasped his arms, and the mule, taking fright at the terrible blow, made off across the plain, and with a few plunges flung its master to the ground. Don Quixote stood looking on very calmly, and when he saw him fall, leaped from his horse, and with great briskness ran to him, and presenting the point of his sword to his eyes, bade him surrender, or he would cut his head off. The Biscayan was so bewildered that he was unable to answer a word, and it would have gone hard with him, so blind was Don Quixote, had not the ladies in the coach, who had hitherto been watching with earnest entreaties to grant them the great grace and favour of sparing their squire's life, to which Don Quixote replied with much gravity and dignity, "In truth, fair ladies, I am well content to do what ye ask of me, but it must be on one condition and understanding, which is, that this knight promise me to go to the village of El Toboso, and on my behalf present himself to the peerless lady Dulcinea, that she deal with him as shall be most pleasing to her." The terrified and disconsolate ladies, without discussing Don Quixote's demand, or asking who Dulcinea might be, promised that their squire should do all that had been commanded. "Then on the faith of that promise," said Don Quixote, "I shall do him no further harm, though he well deserves it of me." Chapter 10. Of the pleasant discourse that passed between Don Quixote and his squire Sancho Panza. Now by this time Sancho had risen, rather the worse for the handling of the friar's muleteers, and stood watching the battle of his master Don Quixote, and praying to God in his heart that it might be his will to grant him the victory, and that he might thereby win some island to make him governor of, as he had promised. Seeing, therefore, that the struggle was now over, and that his master was returning to Mount Rocinante, he approached to hold the stirrup for him, and before he could mount he went on his knees before him, and taking his hand kissed it, saying, "May it please your worship, Señor Don Quixote, to give me the government of that island which has been won in this hard fight, for be it ever so big, I feel myself in sufficient force to be able to govern it as much and as well as any one in the world who has ever governed islands." To which Don Quixote replied, "Thou must take notice, brother Sancho, that this adventure, and those like it, are not adventures of islands, but of crossroads, in which nothing is got except a broken head or an ear the less. Have patience, for adventures will present themselves from which I may make you not only a governor, but something more." Sancho gave him many thanks, and again kissing his hand and the skirt of his hauberk, helped him to mount Rocinante, and mounting his ass himself, proceeded to follow his master, who at a brisk pace, without taking leave or saying anything further to the ladies belonging to the coach, turned into a wood that was hard by. Sancho followed him at his ass's best trot, but Rocinante stepped out so that, seeing himself left behind, he was forced to call to his master to wait for him. Don Quixote did so, reining in Rocinante until his weary squire came up, who on reaching him said, "It seems to me, señor, it would be prudent in us to go and take refuge in some church, for seeing how mauled he with whom you fought has been left, it will be no wonder if they gave information of the affair to the Holy Brotherhood, and arrest us, and faith, if they do, before we come out of jail we shall have to sweat for it." "Peace," said Don Quixote, "where hast thou ever seen or heard that a knight-errant has been arraigned before a court of justice, however many homicides he may have committed?" "I know nothing about homicides," answered Sancho, "nor in my life have had anything to do with one. I only know that the Holy Brotherhood looks after those who fight in the fields, and in that other matter I do not meddle." "Then thou needest have no uneasiness, my friend," said Don Quixote, "for I will deliver thee out of the hands of the Chaldeans, much more out of those of the Brotherhood. But tell me, as thou livest, hast thou seen a more valiant knight than I in all the known world? Hast thou read it in the history of any who has or had higher mettle in attack, more spirit in maintaining it, more dexterity in wounding, or skill in overthrowing?" "The truth is," said Sancho, "that I have never read any history, for I can neither read nor write. But what I will venture to bet is that a more daring master than your worship I have never served in all the days of my life, and God grant that this daring be not paid for where I have said. What I beg of your worship is to dress your wound, for a great deal of blood flows from that ear, and I have here some lint and a little white ointment in the alforjas." "All that might be well dispensed with," said Don Quixote, "if I had remembered to make a vial of the balsam of fierabras, for time and medicine are saved by one single drop." "What vial and what balsam is that?" said Sancho Panza. "It is a balsam," answered Don Quixote, "the receipt of which I have in my memory, with which one need have no fear of death or dread dying of any wound. And so when I make it and give it to thee, thou hast nothing to do when in some battle thou seest they have cut me in half through the middle of the body, as is wont to happen frequently, but neatly and with great nicety, ere the blood congeal, to place that portion of the body which shall have fallen to the ground upon the other half which remains in the saddle, taking care to fit it on evenly and exactly. Then thou shalt give me to drink but two drops of the balsam I have mentioned, and thou shalt see me become sounder than an apple." "If that be so," said Panza, "I renounce henceforth the government of the promised island, and desire nothing more in payment of my many and faithful services than that your worship give me the receipt of this supreme liquor, for I am persuaded that it will be worth more than 2 reals an ounce anywhere, and I want no more to pass the rest of my life in ease and honor, but it remains to be told if it costs much to make it. With less than 3 reals, 6 quarts of it may be made, said Don Quixote. Sinner that I am, said Sancho, why does your worship put off making it and teaching it to me? Peace, friend, answered Don Quixote. Greater secrets I mean to teach thee, and greater favors to bestow upon thee. And for the present, let us see to the dressing, for my ear pains me more than I could wish. Sancho took out some lint and ointment from the alforjas, but when Don Quixote came to see his helmet shattered, he was like to lose his senses, and clapping his hand upon his sword and raising his eyes to heaven, he said, I swear by the Creator of all things and the 4 Gospels in their fullest extent, to do as the great Marquis of Mantua did when he swore to avenge the death of his nephew Baldwin, and that was not to eat bread from a tablecloth, nor embrace his wife, and other points which, though I cannot now call them to mind, I hear Grant has expressed, until I take complete vengeance upon him who has committed such an offense against me. Hearing this, Sancho said to him, Your worship should bear in mind, Señor Don Quixote, that if the knight has done what was commanded him in going to present himself before my lady Dulcinea del Toboso, he will have done all that he was bound to do, and does not deserve further punishment until he commits some new offense. Thou hast said well and hit the point, answered Don Quixote, and so I recall the oath in so far as it relates to taking fresh vengeance on him, but I make and confirm it anew to lead the life I have said until such time as I take by force from some knight another helmet such as this and as good. And think not, Sancho, that I am raising smoke with straw in doing so, for I have one to imitate in this matter, since the very same thing to a hair happened in the case of Mambrino's helmet, which cost Sacripante so dear. Señor, replied Sancho, let your worship send all such oaths to the devil, for they are very pernicious to salvation and prejudicial to the conscience. Just tell me now, if for several days to come we fall in with no man armed with a helmet, what are we to do? Is the oath to be observed in spite of all the inconvenience and discomfort it will be to sleep in your clothes, and not to sleep in a house, and 1,000 other mortifications contained in the oath of that old fool the Marquis of Mantua, whom your worship is now wanting to revive? Let your worship observe that there are no men in armor traveling on any of these roads, nothing but carriers and carters, who do not only not wear helmets, but perhaps have never heard of them all their lives. Thou art wrong there, said Don Quixote, for we shall not have been above 2 hours among these crossroads before we see more men in armor than came to Albracca to win the fair Angelica. Enough, said Sancho, so be it then, and God grant us success, and that the time for winning that island which is costing me so dear may soon come, and then let me die. I have already told thee, Sancho, said Don Quixote, not to give thyself any uneasiness on that score. For if an island should fail, there is the kingdom of Denmark, or of Sobradisa, which will fit thee as a ring fits the finger, and all the more that, being on terra firma, thou wilt all the better enjoy thyself. But let us leave that to its own time. See if thou hast anything for us to eat in those alforjas, because we must presently go in quest of some castle where we may lodge to-night and make the balsam I told thee of. For I swear to thee by God, this ear is giving me great pain. I have here an onion and a little cheese and a few scraps of bread, said Sancho. But they are not victuals fit for a valiant knight like your worship. How little thou knowest about it, answered Don Quixote. I would have thee to know, Sancho, that it is the glory of knights-errant to go without eating for a month, and even when they do eat, that it should be of what first comes to hand. And this would have been clear to thee had thou read as many histories as I have, for though they are very many, among them all I have found no mention made of knights-errant eating, unless by accident or at some sumptuous banquets prepared for them, and the rest of the time they passed in dalliance. And though it is plain they could not do without eating and performing all the other natural functions, because in fact they were men like ourselves, it is plain too that, wandering as they did the most part of their lives through woods and wilds without a cook, their most usual fare would be rustic viands such as those thou now offer me. So that, friend Sancho, let not that distress thee which pleases me, and do not seek to make a new world, or pervert knight-errantry. Pardon me, your worship, said Sancho. For as I cannot read or write, as I said just now, I neither know nor comprehend the rules of the profession of chivalry. Henceforward, I will stock the alforjas with every kind of dry fruit for your worship, as you are a knight. As for myself, if I am not one, I will furnish them with poultry, and other things more substantial. I do not say, Sancho," replied Don Quixote, "that it is imperative on knights-errant not to eat anything else but the fruits thou speakest of, only that their more usual diet must be these, and certain herbs they found in the fields, which they knew, and I know too." "A good thing it is," answered Sancho, "to know these herbs, for to my thinking it will be needful some day to put that knowledge into practice." And here, taking out what he said he had brought, the pair made their repast peaceably and sociably. But anxious to find quarters for the night, they, with all dispatch, made an end of their poor dry fare, mounted at once, and made haste to reach some habitation before night set in. But daylight and the hope of succeeding in their object failed them close by the huts of some goatherds, so they determined to pass the night there. And it was as much to Sancho's discontent not to have reached a house, as it was to his master's satisfaction to sleep under the open heaven, for he fancied that each time this happened to him, he performed an act of ownership that helped to prove his chivalry. Chapter 11. What befell Don Quixote with certain goatherds. He was cordially welcomed by the goatherds, and Sancho, having as best as he could put up Rocinante and the ass, drew toward the fragrance that came from some pieces of salted goat simmering in a pot on the fire, and though he would have liked at once to try if they were ready to be transferred from the pot to the stomach, he refrained from doing so as the goatherds removed them from the fire, and laying sheepskins on the ground, quickly spread their rude table, and with signs of hearty goodwill invited them both to share what they had. Round the skin, six of the men belonging to the fold seated themselves, having first, with rough politeness, pressed Don Quixote to take a seat upon a trough, which they placed for him upside down. Don Quixote seated himself, and Sancho Panza remained standing to serve the cup, which was made of horn. Seeing him standing, his master said to him, "That thou mayest see, Sancho, the good that knight-errantry contains in itself, and how those who fill any office in it are on the high road to be speedily honoured and esteemed by the world, I desire that thou seat thyself here at my side, and in the company of these worthy people, and that thou be one with me, who am thy master and natural lord, and that thou eat from my plate, and drink from whatever I drink from. For the same may be said of knight-errantry as of love, that it levels all." "Great thanks," said Sancho. "But I may tell your worship that, provided I have enough to eat, I can eat it as well or better standing, and by myself, than seated alongside an emperor. And indeed, if the truth is to be told, what I eat in my corner without form or fuss has much more relish for me, even though it be bread and onions, than the turkeys of those other tables where I am forced to chew slowly, drink little, wipe my mouth every minute, and cannot sneeze or cough if I want, or do other things that are the privileges of liberty and solitude. So, senor, as for those honours which your worship would put upon me as a servant and follower of knight-errantry, exchange them for other things which may be of more use and advantage to me. For these, though I fully acknowledge them as received, I renounce from this moment to the end of the world." "For all that," said Don Quixote, "thou must seat thyself, because him who humbleth himself God exalteth." And seizing him by the arm, he forced him to sit down beside himself. The goatherds did not understand this jargon about squires and knights-errant, and all they did was to eat in silence and stare at their guests, who with great elegance and appetite were stowing away pieces as big as one's fist. The course of meat finished, they spread upon the sheepskins a great heap of parched acorns, and with them they put down a half-cheese harder than if it had been made of mortar. All this while the horn was not idle, for it went round so constantly, now full, now empty, like the bucket of a water-wheel, that it soon drained one of the two wineskins that were in sight. When Don Quixote had quite appeased his appetite, he took up a handful of the acorns, and contemplating them attentively, delivered himself somewhat in this fashion: "Happy the age, happy the time, to which the ancients gave the name of golden. Not because in that fortunate age the gold so coveted in this iron one was gained without toil, but because they that lived in it knew not the two words mine and thine. In that blessed age all things were in common. To win the daily food no labor was required of any, save to stretch forth his hand and gather it from the sturdy oaks that stood generously inviting him with their sweet, ripe fruit. The clear streams and running brooks yielded their savory, limpid waters in noble abundance. The busy and sagacious bees fixed their republic in the clefts of the rocks and hollows of the trees, offering without usance the plenteous produce of their fragrant toil to every hand. The mighty cork trees, unenforced save of their own courtesy, shed the broad light bark that it served at first to roof the houses supported by rude stakes, a protection against the inclemency of heaven alone. Then all was peace, all friendship, all concord, as yet the dull share of the crooked plough had not yet dared to rend and pierce the tender bowels of our first mother, that without compulsion yielded from every portion of her broad, fertile bosom all that could satisfy, sustain, and delight the children that then possessed her. Then it was that the innocent and fair young shepherdess roamed from vale to vale and hill to hill, with flowing locks, and no more garments than were needful modestly to cover what modesty seeks and ever sought to hide. Nor were their ornaments like those in use today, set off by Tyrian purple, and silk tortured in endless fashions, but the wreathed leaves of the green dock and ivy, wherewith they went as bravely and becomingly decked as our court dames, with all the rare and far-fetched artifices that idle curiosity has taught them. Then the love-thoughts of the heart clothed themselves simply and naturally as the heart conceived them, nor sought to commend themselves by forced and rambling verbiage. Fraud, deceit, or malice had then not yet mingled with truth and sincerity. Justice held her ground, undisturbed and unassailed by the efforts of favour and of interest that now so much impair, pervert, and beset her. Arbitrary law had not yet established itself in the mind of the judge, for then there was no cause to judge, and no one to be judged. Maidens and modesty, as I have said, wandered at will, alone and unattended, without fear of insult from lawlessness or libertine assault, and if they were undone, it was of their own will and pleasure. But now, in this hateful age of ours, no one is safe, not though some new labyrinth like that of Crete conceal and surround her. Even there the pestilence of gallantry will make its way to them through chinks or on the air by the zeal of its accursed importunity, and despite of all seclusion, lead them to ruin. In defence of these, as time advanced and wickedness increased, the order of knights-errant was instituted, to defend maidens, to protect widows, and to succour the orphans and the needy. To this order I belong, brother Goatherts, to whom I return thanks for the hospitality, and kindly welcome ye, offer me and my squire. For though by natural law all living are bound to show favour to knights-errant, yet seeing that without knowing this obligation you have welcomed and feasted me, it is right that with all the good will in my power I should thank you for yours. All this long harangue, which might very well have been spared, our knight delivered because the acorns they gave him reminded him of the golden age, and the whim seized him to address all this unnecessary argument to the goatherds, who listened to him gaping in amazement without saying a word in reply. Sancho likewise held his peace and ate acorns, and paid repeated visits to the second wineskin, which they had hung up on a cork tree to keep the wine cool. Don Quixote was longer in talking than the supper in finishing, at the end of which one of the goatherds said, "That your worship, Señor Knight-errant, may say with more truth that we show you hospitality with ready good-will, we will give you amusement and pleasure by making one of our comrades sing. He will be here before long, and he is a very intelligent youth and deep in love, and what is more, he can read and write and play on the rebeck to perfection." The goatherd had hardly done speaking when the notes of the rebeck reached their ears. And shortly after, the player came up, a very good-looking young man of about 22. His comrades asked him if he had supped, and on his replying that he had, he who had already made the offer said to him, "In that case, Antonio, thou mayst as well do us the pleasure of singing a little, that the gentleman, our guest, may see that even the mountains and woods there are musicians. We have told him of thy accomplishments, and we want thee to show them and prove that we say true. So as thou livest, pray sit down, and sing that ballad about thy love that thy uncle the prebendary made thee, and that was so much liked in the town." "With all my heart," said the young man, and without waiting for more pressing he seated himself on the trunk of a felled oak, and tuning his rebeck, presently began to sing these words. Antonio's Ballad. Thou dost love me well, Olalla. Well I know it, even though love's mute tongues, thine eyes, have never, by thy glances, told me so. For I know my love thou knowest, therefore thine to claim I dare. Once it ceases to be secret, love need never feel despair. True it is, Olalla, sometimes thou hast all too plainly shown that thy heart is brass in hardness, and thy snowy bosom stone. Yet for all that, in thy coyness, and thy fickle fits between, hope is there. At least the border of her garment may be seen. Lures to faith are they, those glimpses, and to faith in thee I hold. Kindness cannot make it stronger, coldness cannot make it cold. If it be that love is gentle, in thy gentleness I see something holding out assurance to the hopes of winning me. If it be that in devotion lies a power hearts to move, that which every day I show thee helpful to my suit should prove. Many a time thou must have noticed, if to notice thou dost care, how I go about on Monday, dressed in all my Sunday wear. Love's eyes love to look on brightness, love loves what is gaily dressed. Sunday, Monday, all I care is thou shouldst see me in my best. No account I make of dances, or of strains that please thee so, keeping me awake from midnight till the cocks began to crow, or of how I roundly swore it that there's none so fair as thou. True it is, but as I said it, by the girls I'm hated now. For Teresa of the hillside, at my praise of thee, was sore, said, You think you love an angel, it's a monkey you adore, caught by all her glittering trinkets, and her borrowed braids of hair, and a host of made-up beauties, that would love himself ensnare. 'Twas a lie, and so I told her, and her cousin, at the word, gave me his defiance for it, and what followed thou hast heard. Mine is no high-flown affection, mine no passion par amours. As they call it, what I offer is an honest love, and pure. Cunning cords the holy church has, cords of softest silk they be. Put thy neck beneath the yoke, dear, mine will follow, thou wilt see. Else, and once for all I swear it, by a saint of most renown, if I ever quit the mountains, 'twill be in a friar's gown. Here the goatherd brought his song to an end, and though Don Quixote entreated him to sing more, Sancho had no mind that way, being more inclined for sleep than for listening to songs. So said he to his master, Your worship will do well to settle at once where you mean to pass the night, for the labor these good men are at all day does not allow them to spend the night in singing. I understand thee, Sancho, replied Don Quixote. I perceive clearly that those visits to the wineskin demand compensation in sleep rather than in music. It's sweet to us all, blessed be God, said Sancho. I do not deny it, replied Don Quixote, but settle thyself while thou wilt. Those of my calling are more becomingly employed in watching than in sleeping. Still, it would be as well if thou wert to dress this ear for me again, for it is giving me more pain than it need. Sancho did as he bade him, but one of the goatherds, seeing the wound, told him not to be uneasy, as he would apply a remedy with which it would soon be healed, and gathering some leaves of rosemary, of which there was a great quantity there, he chewed them and mixed them with a little salt, and applying them to the ear he secured them firmly with a bandage, assuring him that no other treatment would be required, and so it proved. Chapter 12. Of What a Goatherd Related to Those with Don Quixote. Just then another young man, one of those who fetched their provisions from the village, came up and said, Do you know what is going on in the village, comrades? How could we know it? Replied one of them. Well, then you must know, continued the young man, this morning, that the famous student shepherd called Chrysostom died, and it is rumored that he died of love for that devil of a village girl, the daughter of Guillermo the Rich, she that wanders about the wolds here in the dress of a shepherdess. Do you mean Marcella? Said one. Her, I mean, answered the goatherd, and the best of it is, he has directed in his will that he is to be buried in the fields like a moor, and at the foot of the rock where the cork tree spring is, because, as the story goes, and they say he himself said so, that was the place where he first saw her, and he has also left other directions which the clergy of the village say should not and must not be obeyed, because they savor of paganism. To all which his great friend Ambrosio the student, he who, like him, also went about dressed as a shepherd, replies that everything must be done without any omission according to the directions left by Chrysostom, and about this the village is all in commotion. However, report says that, after all, what Ambrosio and all the shepherds his friends desire will be done, and tomorrow they are coming to bury him with great ceremony where I said. I am sure it will be something worth seeing. At least I will not fail to go and see it, even if I know I should not return to the village tomorrow. We will do the same, answered the goatherds, and cast lots to see who must stay to mind the goats of all. Thou sayest well, Pedro, said one, though there will be no need of taking that trouble, for I will stay behind for all, and don't suppose it is virtue or want of curiosity in me. It is the splinter that ran into my foot the other day that will not let me walk. For all that we thank thee, answered Pedro. Don Quixote asked Pedro to tell him who the dead man was, and who the shepherdess, to which Pedro replied that all he knew was that the dead man was a wealthy gentleman belonging to a village in those mountains, who had been a student at Salamanca for many years, at the end of which he returned to his village with the reputation of being very learned and deeply read. Above all, they said, he was learned in the science of the stars, and of what went on yonder in the heavens and the sun and the moon, for he told us of the crisis of the sun and the moon to the exact time. Eclipse, it is called, friend, not Christ, the darkening of those two luminaries, said Don Quixote. But Pedro, not troubling himself with trifles, went on with his story, saying, Also he foretold when the year was going to be one of abundance or estility. Sterility, you mean, said Don Quixote. "Sterility or estility," answered Pedro, "it is all the same in the end. And I can tell you that by this his father and friends who believed him grew very rich, because they did as he advised them, bidding them sow barley this year, not wheat. This year you may sow pulse and not barley. The next there will be a full oil crop, and the three following not a drop will be got." "That science is called astrology," said Don Quixote. "I do not know what it is called," replied Pedro, "but I know that he knew all this and more besides. But to make an end, not many months had passed after he returned from Salamanca, when one day he appeared dressed as a shepherd with his crook and sheepskin, having put off the long gown he wore as a scholar, and at the same time his great friend, Ambrosio by name, who had been his companion in his studies, took to the shepherd's dress with him. I forgot to say that Chrysostom, who is dead, was a great man for writing verses, so much so that he made carols for Christmas Eve and plays for Corpus Christi, which the young men of our village acted, and all said they were excellent. When the villagers saw the two scholars so unexpectedly appearing in shepherd's dress, they were lost in wonder, and could not guess what had led them to make so extraordinary a change. About this time the father of our Chrysostom died, and he was left heir to a large amount of property in chattels as well as in land, no small number of cattle and sheep, and a large sum of money, of all of which the young man was left dissolute owner, and indeed he was deserving of it all, for he was a very good comrade, and kind-hearted, and a friend of worthy folk, and had a countenance like a benediction. Presently it came to be known that he had changed his dress with no other object than to wander about these wastes, after that shepherdess Marcella our lad mentioned a while ago, with whom the deceased Chrysostom had fallen in love. And I must tell you now, for it is well you should know it, who this girl is. Perhaps, and even without any perhaps, you will not have heard anything like it in all the days of your life, though you should live more days than Sarna. "Se sara," said Don Quixote, unable to endure the goatherd's confusion of words. "The Sarna lives long enough," answered Pedro, "and if, senor, you must go finding fault with words at every step, we shall not make an end of it this twelvemonth." "Pardon me, friend," said Don Quixote, "but as there is such a difference between Sarna and Sara, I told you of it. However, you have answered very rightly, for Sarna lives longer than Sara, so continue your story, and I will not object any more to anything." "I will say then, my dear sir," said the goatherd, "that in our village there was a farmer even richer than the father of Chrysostom, who was named Guillermo, and upon whom God bestowed, over and above great wealth, a daughter, at whose birth her mother died, the most respected woman there was in this neighbourhood. I fancy I can see her now with that countenance which had the sun on one side and the moon on the other, and moreover active, and kind to the poor, for which I trust that at the present moment her soul is in bliss with God in the other world. Her husband Guillermo died of grief at the death of so good a wife, leaving his daughter Marcella, a child and rich, to the care of an uncle of hers, a priest and prebendary in our village. The girl grew up with such beauty that it reminded us of her mother's, which was very great, and yet it was thought that the daughter would exceed it, and so when she reached the age of 14 to 15 years old, nobody beheld her but blessed God that he had made her so beautiful, and the greater number were in love with her past redemption. Her uncle kept her in great seclusion and retirement, but for all that the fame of her great beauty spread, so that, as well for it as for her great wealth, her uncle was asked, solicited, and importuned to give her in marriage not only by those of our town, but of those many leagues round, and by the persons of highest quality in them. But he, being a good Christian man, though he desired to give her in marriage at once, seeing her to be old enough, was unwilling to do so without her consent. Not that he had any eye to the gain and profit which the custody of the girl's property brought him while he put off her marriage, and faith, this was said in praise of the good priest in more than one set in town. For I would have you know, Sir Errant, that in these little villages everything is talked about, and everything is carped at, and rest assured, as I am, that the priest must be over and above good who forces his parishioners to speak well of him, especially in villages. That is the truth, said Don Quixote. But go on, for the story is very good, and you, good Pedro, tell it with very good grace. May that of the Lord not be wanting to me, said Pedro. That is the one to have. To proceed, you must know that though the uncle put before his niece and described to her the qualities of each one in particular of the many who had asked her in marriage, begging her to marry and to make a choice according to her own taste, she never gave any other answer than that she had no desire to marry just yet, and that being so young, she did not think herself fit to bear the burden of matrimony. At these, to all appearance, reasonable excuses that she made, her uncle ceased to urge her, and waited till she was somewhat more advanced in age, and could mate herself to her own liking. For, said he, and he said quite right, parents are not to settle children in life against their will. But when one least looked for it, lo and behold, one day the demure Marcella makes her appearance turn shepherdess, and in spite of her uncle and all those of the town that strove to dissuade her, took to going afield with the other shepherd lasses of the village, and tending her own flock. And so, since she appeared in public, and her beauty came to be seen openly, I could not well tell you how many rich youths, gentlemen, and peasants have adopted the costume of Chrysostom, and go about these fields making love to her. One of these, as has already been said, was our deceased friend, of whom they say that he did not love but adore her. But you must not suppose, because Marcella chose a life of such liberty and independence, and of so little or rather no retirement, that she has given any occasion, or even the semblance of one, for disparagement of her purity and modesty. On the contrary, such and so great is the vigilance with which she watches over her honour, that all of those who court and woo her, not one has boasted, or can with truth boast, that she has given him any hope, however small, of obtaining his desire. For although she does not avoid or shun the society and conversation of the shepherds, and treats them courteously and kindly, should any one of them come to declare his intention to her, though it be one as proper and holy as that of matrimony, she flings him from her like a catapult. And with this kind of disposition, she does more harm in this country than if the plague had gotten into it, for her affability and her beauty draw on the hearts of those that associate with her to love and court her, but her scorn and her frankness bring them to the brink of despair, and so they know not what to say save to proclaim her aloud cruel and hard-hearted, and other names of the same sort, which well describe the nature of her character. And if you should remain here any time, Señor, you would hear these hills and valleys resounding with the laments of the rejected ones who pursue her. Not far from this there is a spot where there are a couple of dozen tall beeches, and there is not one of them but has carved and written on its smooth bark the name of Marcella, and above some a crown carved on the same tree, as though her lover would say more plainly that Marcella wore and deserved that of all human beauty. Here one shepherd is sighing, there another is lamenting, there love songs are heard, here despairing elegies. One will pass all the hours of the night seated at the front of some oak or rock, and there, without having closed his weeping eyes, the sun finds him in the morning, bemused and bereft of senses, and another, without relief or respite to his sighs, stretched on the burning sand in the full heat of the sultry summer noontide, makes his appeal to the compassionate heavens, and over one and the other, over these and all, the beautiful Marcella triumphs free and careless. And all of us that know her are waiting to see what her pride will come to, and who is to be the happy man that will succeed in taming a nature so formidable, and gaining possession of a beauty so supreme. All that I have told you being such well-established truth, I am persuaded that what they say of the cause of Chrysostom's death, as our lad told us, is the same. And so I advise you, Señor, fail not to be present at his burial, which will be well worth seeing, for Chrysostom had many friends, and it is not half a league from this place to where he directed he should be buried. I will make a point of it, said Don Quixote, and I thank you for the pleasure you have given me by relating so interesting a tale. Oh, said the goatherd, I do not even know the half of what has happened to the lovers of Marcella, but perhaps tomorrow we may fall in with some shepherd on the road who can tell us, and now it will be well for you to go and sleep under cover. For the night air may hurt your wound, though with the remedy I have applied to you there is no fear of an untoward result. Sancho Panza, who was wishing the goatherd's loquacity at the devil, on his part begged his master to go into Pedro's hut to sleep. He did so, and passed all the rest of the night in thinking of his lady Dulcinea, in imitation of the lovers of Marcella. Sancho Panza settled himself between Rocinante and his ass, and slept, not like a lover who had been discarded, but like a man who had been soundly kicked. Chapter 13. In which is ended the story of the shepherdess Marcella, with other incidents. But hardly had day begun to show itself through the balconies of the east, when five of the six goatherds came to rouse Don Quixote, and tell him that if he was still of a mind to go and see the famous burial of Chrysostom, they would bear him company. Don Quixote, who desired nothing better, rose and ordered Sancho to saddle and panel at once, which he did with all dispatch, and with the same they all set out forthwith. They had not gone a quarter of a league when at the meeting of two paths they saw coming towards them some six shepherds dressed in black sheepskins, and with their heads crowned with garlands of cypress and bitter oleander. Each of them carried a stout holly staff in his hand, and along with them there came two men of quality on horseback in handsome travelling dress, with three servants on foot accompanying them. courteous salutations were exchanged on meeting, and inquiring one of the other which way each party was going, they learned that all were bound for the scene of the burial, so they all went on together. One of those on horseback, addressing his companion, said to him, "It seems to me, Signor Vivaldo, that we may reckon as well spent the delay we shall incur in seeing this remarkable funeral, for remarkable it cannot but be, judging by the strange things these shepherds have told us, of both the dead shepherd and the homicide shepherdess." "So I think too," replied Vivaldo, "and I would delay not to say a day, but four, for the sake of seeing it." Don Quixote asked them what it was they had heard of Marcela and Chrysostom. The traveller answered that the same morning they had met these shepherds, and seeing them dressed in this mournful fashion, they had asked them the reason of their appearing in such a guise, which one of them gave, describing the strange behaviour and beauty of a shepherdess called Marcela, and the loves of many who courted her, together with the death of that Chrysostom to whose burial they were going. In short, he repeated all that Pedro had related to Don Quixote. This conversation dropped, and another was commenced by him who was called Vivaldo, asking Don Quixote what was the reason that led him to go armed in that fashion in a country so peaceful, to which Don Quixote replied, "The pursuit of my calling does not allow or permit me to go in any other fashion. Easy life, enjoyment, and repose were invented for soft courtiers, but toil, unrest, and arms were invented and made for those alone whom the world calls knight-errant, of whom I, though unworthy, am the least of all." The instant they heard this, all set him down as mad, and the better to settle the point and discover what kind of madness his was, Vivaldo proceeded to ask him what knight-errant meant. "Have not your worships," replied Don Quixote, "read the annals and histories of England, in which are recorded the famous deeds of King Arthur, whom we, in our proper Castilian, invariably call King Artus, with regard to whom it is an ancient tradition, and commonly received all over that kingdom of Great Britain, that this king did not die, but was changed by magic art into a raven, and that in process of time he is to return to reign and recover his kingdom and scepter, for which reason it cannot be proved that from that time to this any Englishman ever killed a raven? Well then, in the time of this good king, that famous order of chivalry of the Knights of the Round Table was instituted, and the amour of Don Lancelot of the Lake with the Queen Guinevere occurred, precisely as there is related, the go-between and confidant therein being the highly honourable Dame Quintanona, whence came that ballad so well known and widely spread in our Spain, "O never surely was there knight so served by hand of dame, as served was he Sir Lancelot hight when he from Britain came, with all the sweet and delectable course of his achievements in love and war." Handed down from that time, then, this order of chivalry went on extending and spreading itself over many and various parts of the world, and in it, famous and renowned for their deeds, were the mighty Amadis of Gaul, with all his sons and descendants to the fifth generation, and the valiant Felix Marte of Hircania, and the never sufficiently praised Tirante el Blanco. And in our own days, almost, we have seen and heard and talked with the invincible knight Don Belianis of Greece. This, then, sirs, is to be a knight-errant, and what I have spoken of is the order of his chivalry, of which, as I have already said, I, though a sinner, have made profession, and what the aforesaid knights professed, that same I do profess. And so I go through these solitudes and wilds seeking adventures, resolved in soul to oppose my arm and person to the most perilous that fortune may offer me, in aid of the weak and needy." By these words of his, the travellers were able to satisfy themselves of Don Quixote's being out of his senses, and of the form of madness that overmastered him, at which they felt the same astonishment that all felt on first becoming acquainted with it. And Vivaldo, who was a person of great shrewdness and of a lively temperament, in order to beguile the short journey which they said was required to reach the mountain, the scene of the burial, sought to give him an opportunity of going on with his absurdities. So he said to him, "It seems to me, Signor Knight-errant, that your worship has made choice of one of the most austere professions in the world, and I imagine even that of the Carthusian monks is not so austere." "As austere it may perhaps be," replied our Don Quixote, "but so necessary for the world I am very much inclined to doubt. For if the truth is to be told, the soldier who executes what his captain orders does no less than the captain himself who gives the order. My meaning is, that churchmen, in peace and quiet, pray to heaven for the welfare of the world, but we soldiers and knights carry into effect what they pray for, defending it with the might of our arms and the edge of our swords, not under shelter, but in the open air, a target for the intolerable rays of the sun in summer and the piercing frosts of winter. Thus are we God's ministers on earth, and the arms by which his justice is done therein. and as the business of war and all that relates and belongs to it cannot be conducted without exceeding great sweat, toil, and exertion, it follows that those who make it their profession have undoubtedly more labor than those who in tranquil peace and quiet are engaged in praying to God to help the weak. I do not mean to say, nor does it enter into my thoughts, that the knight's errant calling is as good as that of the monk in his cell. I would merely infer from what I endure myself that it is beyond a doubt a more laborious and a more belabored one, a hungrier and thirstier, a wretcheder, raggeder, and lousier. For there is no reason to doubt that the knights errant of yore endured much hardship in the course of their lives, and if some of them, by the might of their arms, did rise to be emperors, in faith it cost them dear in the matter of blood and sweat, and if those who attained to that rank had not had magicians and sages to help them, they would have been completely balked in their ambition, and disappointed in their hopes. "That is my own opinion," replied the traveller. "But one thing among many others seems to me very wrong in knights-errant, and that is that when they find themselves about to engage in some mighty and perilous adventure in which there is manifest danger of losing their lives, they never, at the moment of engaging in it, think of commending themselves to God, as is the duty of every good Christian in like peril, instead of which they commend themselves to their ladies with as much devotion as if they were their gods, a thing which seems to me to savour somewhat of heathenism." "Sir," answered Don Quixote, "that cannot on any account be admitted, and the knight-errant would be disgraced who acted otherwise, for it is usual and customary in knight-errantry that the knight-errant, who on engaging in any great feat of arms has his lady before him, should turn his eyes toward her softly and lovingly, as though with them entreating her to favour and protect him in the hazardous venture he is about to undertake, and even though no one hear him, he is bound to say certain words between his teeth, commending himself to her with all his heart, and of this we have innumerable instances in the histories. Nor is it to be supposed from this that they are to omit commending themselves to God, for there will be time and opportunity for doing so while they are engaged in their task." "For all that," answered the traveller, "I feel some doubt still, because often I have read how words will arise between two knights-errant, and from one thing to another it comes about that their anger kindles, and they wheel their horses round, and take a good stretch of field, and then, without any more ado, at the top of their speed they come to the charge, and in mid-career they are wont to commend themselves to their ladies. And what commonly comes of the encounter is that one falls over the haunches of his horse, pierced through and through by his antagonist's lance, and for the other it is only by holding on to the mane of his horse that he can help falling to the ground. But I know not how the dead man had time to commend himself to God in the course of such rapid work as this. It would have been better if those words which he spent in commending himself to his lady, in the midst of his career, had been devoted to his duty and obligation as a Christian. Moreover, it is my belief that all knights-errant have not ladies to commend themselves to, for they are not all in love." "That is impossible," said Don Quixote. "I say it is impossible that there could be a knight-errant without a lady, because to such it is as natural and proper to be in love as to the heavens to have stars. Most certainly no history has been seen in which there is to be found a knight-errant without an amour, and for the simple reason that without one he would be held no legitimate knight but a bastard, and one who had gained entrance into the stronghold of the said knighthood, not by the door, but over the wall like a thief and a robber." "Nevertheless," said the traveller, "if I remember rightly, I think I have read that Don Galaor, the brother of the valiant Amadis of Gaul, never had any special lady to whom he might commend himself, and yet he was not the less esteemed, and was a very stout and famous knight." To which our Don Quixote made answer, "Sir, one solitary swallow does not make summer. Moreover, I know that knight was in secret very deeply in love. Besides which, that way of falling in love with all that took his fancy was a natural propensity which he could not control. But in short, it is very manifest that he had one alone whom he made mistress of his will, to whom he commended himself very frequently and very secretly, for he prided himself on being a reticent knight." "Then if it be essential that every knight-errant should be in love," said the traveller, "it may be fairly supposed that your worship is so, as you are of the order, and if you do not pride yourself on being as reticent as Don Galaor, I entreat you as earnestly as I can, in the name of all this company and in my own, to inform us of the name, country, rank, and beauty of your lady, for she will esteem herself fortunate if all the world knows that she is loved and served by such a knight as your worship seems to be." At this, Don Quixote heaved a deep sigh, and said, "I cannot say positively whether my sweet enemy is pleased or not that the world should know I serve her. I can only say, in answer to what has been so courteously asked of me, that her name is Dulcinea, her country El Toboso, a village of La Mancha. Her rank must be at least that of a princess, since she is my queen and lady, and her beauty superhuman, since all the impossible and fanciful attributes of beauty which the poets apply to their ladies are verified in her. For her hairs are gold, her forehead Elysian fields, her eyebrows rainbows, her eyes suns, her cheeks roses, her lips coral, her teeth pearls, her neck alabaster, her bosom marble, her hands ivory, her fairness snow, and what modesty conceals from sight, such I think and imagine, as rational reflection can only extol, not compare. We should like to know her lineage, race, and ancestry, said Vivaldo. To which Don Quixote replied, She is not of the ancient Roman Curti, Cai, or Scipios, nor of the modern Colonnas or Orsini, nor the Moncadas or Riscenias of Catalonia, nor yet of the Rebellas or Villanovas of Valencia, Palafoxes, Nusas, Rocabertis, Corellas, Lunas, Alagones, Oreas, Foces, or Correas of Aragon, Cerdas, Manriques, Mendozas, or Guzmans of Castile, Alencastros, Palas, or Menceses of Portugal. But she is of those of El Toboso of La Mancha, a lineage that, though modern, may furnish a source of gentle blood for the most illustrious families of the ages that are to come, and let none dispute with me save on the condition that Cerbino placed at the foot of the trophy of Orlando's arms, saying, These let none move who dareth not his might with Roland prove. Although mine is of the Cachopins of Laredo, said the traveller, I will not venture to compare it with that of El Toboso of La Mancha, though to tell the truth no such surname has until now ever reached my ears. What? Said Don Quixote. Has that never reached them? The rest of the party went along listening with great attention to the conversation of the pair, and even the very goatherds and shepherds perceived how exceedingly out of his wits our Don Quixote was. Sancho Panza alone thought that what his master said was the truth, knowing who he was and having known him from his birth, and all that he felt any difficulty in believing was that about the fair Dulcinea del Toboso, because neither any such name nor any such princess had ever come to his knowledge, though he lived so close to El Toboso. They were going along conversing in this way, when they saw descending a gap between two high mountains some 20 shepherds, all clad in sheepskins of black wool, and crowned with garlands which, as afterwards appeared, were some of them of yew, some of cypress. Six of the number were carrying a bier covered with a great variety of flowers and branches, on seeing which one of the goatherds said, Those who come there are the bearers of Chrysostom's body, and the foot of that mountain is the place where he ordered them to bury him. They therefore made haste to reach the spot, and did so by the time those who came had laid the bier upon the ground, and four of them, with sharp pickaxes, were digging a grave by the side of a hard rock. They greeted each other courteously, and then Don Quixote and those who accompanied him turned to examine the bier, and on it, covered with flowers, they saw a dead body in the dress of a shepherd, to all appearance of 130 years of age, and showing even in death that in life he had been of comely features and gallant bearing. Around him, on the bier itself, were laid some books, and several papers opened and folded, and those who were looking on, as well as those who were opening the grave, and all the others who were there, preserved a strange silence, until one of those who had borne the body said to another, "Observe carefully, Ambrosia, if this is the place Chrysostom spoke of, since you are anxious that what he directed in his will should be so strictly complied with." "This is the place," answered Ambrosia, "for in it many a time did my poor friend tell me the story of his hard fortune. Here it was, he told me, that for the first time he saw the mortal enemy of the human race, and here, too, for the first time, he declared to her his passion, as honourable as it was devoted, and here it was that at last Marcella ended by scorning and rejecting him, so as to bring the tragedy of his wretched life to a close. Here, in memory of misfortune so great, he desired to be laid in the bowels of eternal oblivion." Then, turning to Don Quixote and the travellers, he went on to say, "That body, sirs, on which you are looking with compassionate eyes, was the abode of a soul on which heaven bestowed a vast share of its riches. That is the body of Chrysostom, who was unrivalled in wit, unequalled in courtesy, unapproached in gentle bearing, a phoenix in friendship, generous without limit, grave without arrogance, gay without vulgarity, and in short, first in all that constitutes goodness and second to none in all that makes up misfortune. He loved deeply, he was hated, he adored, he was scorned. He wooed a wild beast, he pleaded with marvel, he pursued the wind, he cried to the wilderness, he served in gratitude, and for reward was made the prey of death in the mid-course of life, cut short by a shepherdess whom he sought to immortalize in the memory of man, as these papers which you see could fully prove, had he not commanded me to consign them to the fire after having consigned his body to the earth. "You would deal with them more harshly and cruelly than their owner himself," said Vivaldo, "for it is neither right nor proper to do the will of one who enjoins what is wholly unreasonable. It would not have been reasonable in Augustus Caesar had he permitted the directions left by the divine Mantuan in his will to be carried into effect. So that, Signor Ambrosia, while you consign your friend's body to the earth, you should not consign his writings to oblivion. For if he gave the order in bitterness of heart, it is not right that you should irrationally obey it. On the contrary, by granting life to these papers, let the cruelty of Marcella live forever, to serve as a warning in ages to come to all men who shun and avoid falling into like a danger. Or I, and all of us who have come here, know already the story of this your love-stricken and heartbroken friend, and we know too your friendship, and the cause of his death, and the directions he gave at the close of his life, from which sad story may be gathered how great was the cruelty of Marcella, the love of Chrysostom, and the loyalty of your friendship, together with the end awaiting those who pursue rashly the path that insane passion opens to their eyes. Last night we learned of the death of Chrysostom, and that he was to be buried here, and out of curiosity and pity we left our direct road, and resolved to come and see with our eyes that which, when heard of, had so moved our compassion. And in consideration of that compassion, and our desire to prove it, if we might, by condolence, we beg of you, excellent Ambrosia, or at least I on my own account entreat you, that instead of burning these papers you allow me to carry away some of them." And without waiting for the shepherd's answer, he stretched out his hand, and took up some of those that were nearest to him, seeing which Ambrosio said, "Out of courtesy, Signor, I will grant your request as to those you have taken, but it is idle to expect me to abstain from burning the remainder." Vivaldo, who was eager to see what the papers contained, opened one of them at once, and saw that its title was Lay of Despair. Ambrosio, hearing it, said, "That is the last paper the unhappy man wrote, and that you may see, Signor, to what an end his misfortunes brought him. Read it so that you may be heard, for you will have time enough for that while we are waiting for the grave to be dug." "I will do so very willingly," said Vivaldo, and as all the bystanders were equally eager they gathered around him, and he, reading in a loud voice, found that it ran as follows. End of part 4.